Welcome to this edition of the Health Law Expressions podcast. I'm Ian Donaldson, and I'm with my partner, Barbara Blackman. And today we're going to talk about temporary privileges and expedited credentialing, what's required and what's allowed. We all know that rigorous credentialing and privileging is imperative, and makes me think of that commercial that's out there right now for one of the cell phone carriers where they talk about just okay is not okay with the physician who just got reinstated. None of us want to be in that particular situation where we're, you know, meeting the just okay is just okay standard. But we know that rigorous credentialing and privileging does take time. And we're often asked, can we ever consider options that allow a qualified practitioner who doesn't have issues to begin to practice in a more timely manner? We don't mean shortcuts, but common sense steps like granting temporary privileges, right, Barb?
Well, temporary privileges were traditional. In fact, when I first started doing this kind of work, we often would see language in bylaws that said, upon receipt of an application, the individual would be granted temporary privileges. Of course, we all know that the use of temporary privileges has really declined in recent years. It didn't make any sense to provide temporary privileges before primary source verification was complete and the applicant was vetted thoroughly, because the granting of temporary privileges really led to problems. So the accreditation bodies began to tighten the standards. There may be some good reasons to allow certain practitioners to begin to practice once they've been determined to satisfy all qualifications, and you're simply waiting for the meetings to happen. However, as Ian just said, no shortcuts. The granting of temporary privileges does not mean less rigorous vetting. Now, hospitals accredited by the Joint Commission and DNV know that temporary privileges may be granted in two circumstances: a complete, clean application and an important patient care need. So, Ian, what's a clean application?
It's an interesting question, and it depends on who you ask. If you go to the Joint Commission, they talk about how it means you've gone through the verification process, you're awaiting further review, but there aren't any concerns about things like current licensure, relevant training, current competence, the ability to perform the privileges requested. There's also no issues related to current or previously successful challenges to licensure or registration. No subjection to involuntary termination of medical staff membership at another hospital, no subjection to involuntary limitations or reductions or loss of clinical privileges. For those of you out there who are accredited by the DNV, they have a very similar standard. They talk about how the application is complete without any negative or adverse information before the medical staff or governing board can act. And they go through the same type of factors, right? You've completed the primary verification of education, you have demonstration of current clinical competence, you've done your primary verification of any state professional licenses, you've gotten your references, you've reviewed all the appropriate data banks. And so that goes back to, again, when we're talking about clean and complete, your accrediting body does provide some guidance on what that means.
So typically, credentials committees and medical executive committees meet every month, although those meetings are often synced so that they meet back to back, and that enables prompt consideration of applications. Now, a number of years ago, we saw some organizations develop categories of applicants, sometimes at the suggestion of a consultant, with the idea being to separate those applicants who had no issues and those who had issues. So sometimes we still see that shorthand, category one or category two. Whether or not you use that nomenclature or whether you simply say complete clean applications have one process and you have another process for applications that require more study before they're deemed complete. So it's up to you as to how you want to define it in your medical staff documents. Typically, we see that in a credentials policy, sometimes in bylaws. Truly problematic applications may remain incomplete for a very long time, and some may never be complete. And you can control that in your documents by including language that says that if an applicant is asked for more information to clarify or provide answers to questions and they don't provide it within a certain time frame, the application is deemed to be withdrawn. Now, several years ago, some CMS officials made some announcements in training sessions that CMS didn't really like temporary privileges. And then sometimes that was accompanied by a statement that CMS didn't think that temporary privileges should be granted by a CEO. Now, CMS has never codified that in the Medicare conditions of participation or interpretive guidelines. And of course, the accrediting bodies still contain language regarding temporary privileges, and often temporary privileges are granted by a CEO and a president of the medical staff. And that remains okay because CMS approves the accrediting body's standards. So that may have reflected some disagreement internally at CMS, but CMS really has no standards that would prohibit a hospital and medical staff from adopting language that allows for the granting of temporary privileges. Now, that sort of covers the applicants, but Ian, what about important patient care need and particularly locum tenens?
Yeah, that's the other bucket that both Joint Commission and DNV talk about, that we have, you know, the temporary privileges for new applicants and then those where there's an urgent or important patient care need. And often that does take the form of a locums physician. And, you know, Barbara and I just got back recently from one of our educational seminars in Las Vegas, where we do the complete course together for medical staff leaders. And I think we had a number of comments, during the program and during the breaks, where physicians who were in attendance were sort of sharing their horror stories that they had dealt with various locum practitioners they wanted to share with us. And as Barb said, they come under that rubric of important patient care need. Now, it's important to design some sort of policy or process that enables the full vetting as reasonably possible for locums, due to the fact that, as we hear time and time again, often they are folks who, you know, it's a little bit like last chance you, for those of you who follow college football, when maybe somebody's outworn their welcome at all the D1 schools and they end up at a JUCO for various reasons. But, you know, we keep hearing that again and again, that, you know, this is a place where, you know, yes, there are going to be some physicians out there who like the flexibility and they like the change of scenery, but more and more often we're hearing stories about, well, no, the locums we're getting are just people who couldn't go anywhere else. They sort of ran out of options. So, you know, if you look at what, say, for example, the Joint Commission requires in that case, it's a pretty bare bones standard for credentialing. You know, you have to make sure they have a license and that they're currently clinically competent. And so, you know, that just doesn't sit well with most people. You know, at a bare minimum, I think in addition to that, you know, you're picking up the phone, you're doing some verification. I feel like we see, you know, we're calling the last 5 places they were at or the last 10 places they were at, those kind of standards put into policies. You know, again, the locum agency itself is hopefully doing some sort of verification and credentialing on its own, but you certainly can't rely on that. And it varies so much from organization to organization that, you know, you really need to go above and beyond. You know, if you think about the time frame for these folks, I know the Joint Commission talks about how you sort of define the standard for important patient care needs situations. And I don't know, Barb, I feel like we see anywhere from 30 to 60 days, sort of that kind of window in medical staff bylaws. I know I've worked with a number of medical staffs who have made a distinction between, hey, it's a short-term fill-in, right? Somebody's on vacation, somebody's away from the medical staff for whatever reason. We know it's only going to be a couple weeks or it's a service need. You know, they'll sort of track the less restrictive credentialing process that's allowed for in the accreditation standards in that case. But if they know the locums is going to be there for a longer term, essentially they credential them just like they would anyone else on their medical staff, or they at least have a more robust process in place for locums who they know, again, are going to be around a little bit longer. So that gives you some sense of, I guess we want to have some caution there, right? It doesn't hurt to, we always talk about there's policies and there's good policies, right? A policy may be good in that it meets the bare minimum that the accrediting bodies require, but you can certainly always do more. And I feel like this is one where it is nice to and appropriate to maybe do a little bit more homework on the front end for those locums folks, going above and beyond what the basics are required. So with that, I mean, keeping in mind, you know, whenever we're talking about, we mentioned the timing elements here. So whenever you're dealing with temporary privileges, one of the benefits of that is, to some extent, that you do have an expiration date on that, right? When you're granting temporary privileges, there's usually some end date, and when that end date expires and, you know, you don't keep that person around, that doesn't trigger any sort of hearing rights or data bank reports or anything like that. But, you know, while that is beneficial on your end, we do know, at least informally, that CMS has, you know, cast some shade, I guess, on the idea of temporary privileges and instead said, well, we'd rather do like an expedited credentialing process. So, Barb, why don't you talk about that?
Sure. An expedited credentialing process has, in many organizations, almost replaced temporary privileges for new applicants. The expedited process is described in Joint Commission standards in standard MS-0601-11. It basically says that an expedited process can include action by a board committee of two voting board members. Now, it's interesting that the Joint Commission chose to place that in the medical staff standards, even though it applies to the governing body. But basically, the governing body would be allowed in its corporate bylaws or resolution or policy to create a committee of at least two voting board members and delegate to that committee the authority to act on complete clean applications, in essence. There's a lot of overlap between what the Joint Commission views as a proper application for expedited processing compared to what they say for clean applicants for temporary privileges. The composition of this committee is really up to each hospital board. The board can appoint two committee members or maybe three to, it could include the CEO or the CMO. If they have a vote on the board, because it has to be at least two voting board members. A lot of times today, hospital boards engage in strategic planning. They maybe meet only quarterly, so having this board committee can be very helpful to enable the problem-free applicants to begin practicing promptly. The expedited board committee can even meet by telephone. Now, the Joint Commission standards include some language about what applications are proper for consideration for expedited credentialing. And for example, the application has to be complete. Well, of course, that seems rather obvious. The Joint Commission also says that an application, in order to be a proper application for expedited credentialing, generally would not include those that have a current challenge or previously successful challenge to licensure or involuntary termination of medical staff, appointment and privileges at another hospital, or loss of clinical privileges. Now, those types of factors are almost always today included in the threshold eligibility criteria. So an application that had one of those events in many organizations would not even be processed. The other factor that the Joint Commission includes in that standard as not being appropriate for expedited credentialing has to do with an unusual pattern of or excessive number of professional liability actions resulting in a final judgment involving the applicant. But most organizations now have built in this expedited concept into their credentials policies, so long as the application is complete and clean, because there's a lot of overlap, as I said, after the MEC meets, but it can also happen after the credentials committee meets. Since a credentials committee isn't even required, the organization can define the appropriate point. It does have to go through the medical executive committee. So some organizations would allow the credentials chair to confer with the medical executive committee, sometimes through regular attendance by the credentials chair at the MEC. Now, there's no requirement that the full MEC act on every application, and we have seen some organizations create a subcommittee of the full MEC to act on complete clean applications. Now, the DNV standards don't explicitly include an expedited process, but the concept certainly works with DNV standards. So in short, with the understanding that a very thorough background assessment through primary source verification and at least one, we recommend at least one phone call for all applications with a peer who has worked closely with the applicant. And if you have an application that reveals no issues, it makes sense to have a process to allow the candidate to begin practicing as soon as the qualifications are established, waiting for all these meetings to happen. Now, these processes must be designed very carefully to be sure that the organization does not slip into a too casual processing of applications. There's always the potential for political pressure brought to bear by those maybe independent groups or affiliated groups with individuals who would like to get the candidate practicing very quickly, but it's helpful to educate everyone involved in the recruitment process about the importance of credentialing and background checking to explain the process. So in general, we have seen the expedited concept replace, in large part, the temporary privileges for new applicants.
Well, thank you for joining us today. Please rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast wherever you download your favorite shows. And please consider, if you're so inclined, joining Barbara and I for a great time at our medical staff complete course for leaders that we do several times a year. We have a couple of those upcoming if you want to migrate your way to the Horty Springer and Matter website. At those programs, we talk about issues like this in depth over 3.5 days and get into other credentialing and peer review and policy matters that might be important to you. So please check that out, and please continue again to subscribe to our podcast, and we hope that we hear you again. Bye-bye.